Welcome to Responding to ACEs, Resources for Resilience, a continuing medical education podcast series brought to you by the College of the Arts and Media and the College of Medicine at Central Michigan University. Adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, are more prevalent than we think and affect people across all backgrounds. There is mounting evidence that childhood trauma and stress have long-term effects on mental and physical health. The more ACEs a person experiences, the greater the risk of adverse chronic health conditions in adulthood. But there is hope for healing. In this CME podcast series, we will provide you with knowledge, tools, and resources to build a collaborative care approach to addressing ACEs. In this sixth module of Responding to ACEs, Resources for Resilience, you will learn about adults dealing with the effects of ACEs and childhood traumas. The third module recommended screening for ACEs and taking a social history as well as a medical history. This helps healthcare providers connect patients with the necessary resources to find resilience and to face the challenges preventing their well-being. In the fourth module, Dr. Larissa Nietzsche explained the benefits of parent-child interaction therapy, or PCIT. In the fifth module, Dr. Sarah Domoff explained trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, or TFCBT. Both of these modules explain the importance of building loving and nurturing bonds between parents and caregivers and their children. This module will focus on adults and ACEs. Many adults with unresolved ACEs have chronic and acute health conditions, and some adults will deal with ACEs when faced with a health crisis. Dr. Jim Gerhart is a clinical psychologist and professor of psychology at Central Michigan University who studies stress and chronic illness.
My primary experience with ACEs, I guess, is a little bit different because with chronic illness in older adults, usually I'm treating people with cancer, chronic pain, sometimes heart disease. They'd come into my clinic. I was working in Chicago for a number of years, and you'd think that a person who's dealing with cancer would want to talk about their cancer. Many times that's the case, but you talk to people about their history of maybe anxiety that brought them to the clinic. And, you know, a normal question is like, how long has this been bothering you? A number of folks would say, my whole life, what was going on then when it started? And then people start recounting pretty horrific stories of abuse and trauma that they faced as children that they're still sort of living through maybe 70 years later. We did a study at Rush University in Chicago. We published it in 2013. We talked to 139 women who were at doctor's appointments. We gave them surveys that asked about childhood abuse and then other factors that were sort of going on perhaps currently or more recently. These were all adult women. We asked them about their social support. We asked them about interpersonal violence, their emotion regulation, and their PTSD. What we found was people who had more exposures to childhood abuse had less social support. But we want you to have social support, particularly if you face trauma, because that provides a buffer, that provides some healing. But that's actually ironically lower. So it probably comes down to factors like the way our society has been set up and humanity has been set up for thousands of years is you are with your family and then your neighborhood or your community and then your culture. So if you're being abused as a child, usually you maintain some sort of connection. It's hard to let go of a family altogether. The people who are hurting you might be in your life still. It might be difficult to form new relationships if you don't trust people or you can't figure out who to trust. And then that relates to a second issue we saw. A number of these women who were abused in childhood reported being victims of some sort of interpersonal aggression or violence within the past year. So for some of these women, that could have been a gap of decades, potentially. And the concern, again, is, are they still in that same family? Did they potentially adopt interpersonal styles that other people preyed upon? Did they not learn, again, how to detect when somebody's safe or not, and then people took advantage of it? So those are a few of the ways that we think ACEs affect relationships.
Dr. Gerhart explains treating ACEs in adults, but also the preference for finding adversity in children and coping with ACEs before adulthood.
So in terms of treating ACEs, when it results in something like PTSD or depression, we have evidence-based protocols. They tend to be cognitive behavioral treatments that are effective at helping people manage the symptoms, reduce the symptoms, and return to a higher level of functioning in life. That's usually one-on-one or in groups, but that's maybe 10 to 15 people tops in a group like that. We're not going to impact society at the level we need to, treating one person at a time. right now there's a lot of interest in trauma-informed care in medical settings and in schools. And the idea is, how can we be screening to identify people that might be at risk? How do we find the people that have the symptoms? And then what are the appropriate treatments at that level? When it comes to actual prevention, I think there are a number of things that we can do, particularly to help caregivers sort of learn to manage their own emotions that might contribute to abusive behaviors towards children. So here we're talking about sort of the verbal abuse and the physical abuse that sometimes people think is discipline, but usually doesn't function that way. If we empower parents and other caregivers to learn good parenting strategies and really to take care of themselves, that's one potential way to prevent abuse. And then there's sort of the socio-political, cultural component of all this. The challenging thing about ACEs is that a lot of them tend to go together. People that are exposed to trauma might also be dealing with mental illness within the family and struggling with poverty. So one of the big concerns that I have is that where might people go to learn strategies to parent or to cope? Where might children learn strategies to deal with their stress? It's the school or it's the medical office. Unfortunately, the way society is set up is sort of around like tax codes and things like that. So if you end up with a poor school district where children are exposed to more adversity, they just don't have the funds in the school to provide those resources. And so people kind of get trapped there. But adverse child experiences can happen to anyone. And I think that we do make assumptions that it's more likely to happen in some groups, but anyone can be exposed. And as it turns out, a vast majority of children are exposed to something. When you consider the types of events, something like having a parent with mental illness, by the time people reach adulthood, there's about a 50% likelihood that they'll have experienced some sort of diagnosable mental illness. When you look at national samples, substance abuse is common and overlooked. Unfortunately, abuse is rather common as well. Other things that come into play, like illnesses and accidents, can touch any life. Many of these things don't discriminate.
Dr. John Lopez is a professor in the Physician Assistant Program at Central Michigan University, and he also works with opiate addiction.
I work in an opiate treatment program, so all of my patients have opioid use disorder. Many of them have very high ACE scores. Many of them started using substances in childhood, probably associated with the ACEs, some of it associated with their socioeconomic environment where it was available and they were at risk for these sort of behaviors as a result of the exposures to either parental substance use, parental incarceration, disrupted families, homelessness, poverty, and those sorts of things. So right now we're dealing, at least in our patient population, with pretty much the direct effect of having encountered these adverse childhood experiences. The thing that we have to be concerned with is the transgenerational aspect of they were substance users. They often had legal problems. They often suffered from homelessness, poverty, unemployment, family separations. And so the children of our patients are now suffering these adverse childhood events. And so we need to figure out a way to address that in our treating our patients with opioid use disorder to try to mitigate some of the long-term effects of the ACEs that their children experienced.
Seeing the epigenetic and intergenerational impact of ACEs with opiate addiction is powerful. However, Dr. Lopez finds screening of all patients important to help patients find resilience to cope with their ACEs and overcome other health issues.
It's important that everybody who's doing primary care, or even for other providers, depending on the specialty, that you screen all of your patients for ACEs, whether they're adults or children. If they have unresolved symptoms or unresolved issues around whatever adverse childhood experience they have, that's going to interfere with their treatment. So if you have somebody who has PTSD and they have hypertension or something like that, the stress response associated with having PTSD will interfere with your ability to control their blood pressure. I don't know that anybody gets out of life without at least one adverse childhood experience. So you need to screen. And then even if you're not going to treat that person, you need to be able to refer them somewhere to go ahead and get treatment for whatever issue is going on. And again, that's typically the mental health agencies to deal with the traumas typically associated with adverse childhood experiences.
It is important to realize that not all childhood adversity will cause issues in adulthood. Dr. Gerhardt explains.
Most people are actually resilient. Most people are exposed to something in childhood, not necessarily abuse, but someone's going to get sick unexpectedly. Mental illness is pretty common. Most people come out okay. We don't want people to be exposed, but a little bit of exposure sometimes prompts people to develop some coping skills. There might be people with one or two exposures that kind of figure things out. They have social support and they're okay. It's the people with more repeated exposure or who may have been vulnerable for a number of reasons, some sort of vulnerability in their psychology. When that goes untreated, we're worried about a couple of things. The first thing is emotion dysregulation, just strong emotions that aren't well understood, that lead to strong urges. This risks oversimplification, but usually when there's stress, the urge is either to escape or to fight. We want to get rid of that feeling and get out of that situation as quick as possible. That's a fight or flight response. And so what do? A lot of behaviors that really aren't good for our bodies over the long term. Drug use, nicotine use, alcohol abuse, great ways to take care of that feeling immediately. The problem is once that drug wears off, the feeling is still there, sometimes more intensified because you're in withdrawal, you're hungover or something like that. So you feel worse and the problem isn't fixed. Maybe perhaps less obvious but more insidious patterns are that when people are depressed or they're anxious and they avoid, they're not out in their communities. And that means they're getting fewer steps. They're not getting the exercise that they need. And they're not building healthy relationships that make their lives bigger and bigger. At that level, we've gone from emotion regulation to really just health risk behaviors, things that put the body at risk for a number of problems, particularly over the lifespan.
Dr. Gerhardt supports screening for ACEs by healthcare providers, but an ACE score will mean different things for different adult patients.
I think on a case-by-case basis, when we're screening, we have to be really careful to make sure that the patient is empowered to say no if they don't want to talk about it, or that the door is open to talk about it later, or that we can roll them into treatment and get them the services that they need. But I don't know how you would detect anything if you're not screening for it. A lot of us know our ACEs scores. Are we in psychotherapy for it? Are we going to groups? And that comes down to a number of individual factors like your readiness to change and your need for change too. When we've talked about psychology for the last 100, 120 years, there's always been this thing of denial and repression. And a lot of people will say, yeah, a lot of bad stuff happened to me, but I'm better off for it. And you're like, but are you really? Or are you in denial? And those people are hard to work with. I think you put some information out there and you let it sit, it kind of goes from there. Some people are a little more reluctant. And I think this is the patient that's at the doctor's office and they're clearly distressed. There's all the nonverbal signs are there. They're tearful. They're a little more agitated. Perhaps you've been treating some sort of symptom like pain that's just not getting better. Dizziness is another one that goes with anxiety. Gastrointestinal issues. I think there you can use some strategies, things like motivational interviewing, to help people sort of connect the dots over time that this is stress related. Even then, people are resistant to that because they don't want to think you're saying, you're trying to tell me this is in my head. No, my pain is in my back. My pain is in my leg. I'm not making this up. But in a good supportive relationship with a physician, some of those patients will connect the dots and move in that direction of wanting to get treatment. It takes some time and some finesse. In my experience working in a cancer center, we'd get paged by a physician or oncologist, a nurse, to go talk with a patient. And a significant number would say, once they figured out you were from psychology, they kicked you out. And then sometimes it was the case that the patient's mood didn't improve or their appetite didn't improve and we'd be consulted again. And I think it was that familiarity. Eventually they saw, okay, this person thinks this is useful. And then they'd kind of let us in the door to talk. It takes time. We really are talking about ACEs that have an interpersonal component. I think people are allowed to be mistrustful. That mistrust actually could be healthy in some ways. Sometimes with abuse, the message isn't said, but the action kind of conveys it all implicitly. If you're being treated like you're rubbish, children will connect those dots. Then I think the challenge is when you're looking at your physician, you're looking at your nurse, you're looking at your teacher, people that are supposed to care about you, at least at some professional level. I think some people jump to the conclusion that, hey, if my caregiver or the person in my family or the person in my neighborhood that was supposed to look out for me was actually harming me, what are these people that are asking me all these questions and telling me things to do, what do they think about me? How do they view me? And so that's where the distrust comes up. Going through human history, we had a lot of conceptualizations of mental illness that just were not helpful, and we treated people with mental illness pretty terribly from time to time. Obviously, it's getting better, but the stigma still exists.
Dr. Gerhardt has some suggestions for how to deal with patients who seem difficult or in distress.
Trauma-informed care starts with good patient-centered care. The first thing is listen and don't shut down. Don't change the subject. Let that person talk and use good open-ended questions. Tell me more about that. And then you provide some validation. A lot of people will disclose a trauma and they'll at least have the experience. They'll perceive that they've been sort of victim blamed for it. So if there's an interpersonal component, you say something like, I'm sorry that that happened to you. Sometimes people think it's your fault. It's not your fault. That was unfair. That's not right. Some sort of validation. And then you need to convey that it's totally understandable that you're going to have really strong, difficult emotions. And then the next step is to convey that you there, as their healthcare provider, will be with them and will stay with them. The tricky piece is then, usually you need to make a referral if you don't have the mental health expertise. What you don't want to do is leave the patient with the sense that you're outsourcing your empathy, more or less. So you have to say, I'll be here to support you through this, but I want to make sure that you get the best care that you can. I'm going to refer you to so-and-so. And if you don't have a connection, you say, I'm going to find the best person I can with expertise in this. But feel free to come back and keep me updated and talk with me about it. Because what we don't want is people sort of getting bounced around like we do on customer support sometimes when it's such an important event for them. I think the therapeutic or working alliance between the patient and the physician is the most essential thing at that moment. Don't rush. Listen, validate, reflect. One thing that when I've taught medical students is when you hear something with such important weight, maybe that's the time where you realize that you're going to be a few minutes late to your next patient. You got to take your time if you can. That's the hard thing about healthcare is you got to make those little judgment calls sometimes. When patients come through the door, they're usually not excited to be in your office unless they really like you a lot, and hopefully they do. It's a stressful time. If you can be open, if you can read the nonverbal cues, and if you can elicit from patients how they're actually doing emotionally, you've got an opportunity to learn quite a bit about them. You have more and more opportunities with repeated contacts. So there are a couple simple questions I think you can get a lot of information from with the right patient when you have the right relationship. One is, what do I need to know about you to take good care of you? That's a good question to ask during the first time you meet somebody. You might actually learn something interesting or something that helps you like them more. Sometimes they'll tell you about perhaps a problem they didn't want to disclose to you. Another thing that you can say as you get to know a patient pretty well is sometimes there are difficult things people need to talk about and they don't want to talk about it. I'm not here to make you do it, but if there is anything, I'm here to listen. Sometimes that gives people permission to let their guard down. It might not happen right away. It might be a year later, but you've sort of planted a seed that that patient can invest some trust in you. My third piece of advice is that when you see emotion or you experience emotion, you don't have to judge it. You can sort of take that mindful approach to letting it be there, deciding if it's useful to pay attention to or not, and move forward. And I think you can give your patients permission to feel their emotions as well. You can say, hey, nobody's excited to be here, but I'm here to listen and support you through whatever you need, whether that's medical or emotional or social.
There is a connection between ACEs and poor physical and mental health. The problem is the effects of ACEs are not uniform. Some patients will easily find resilience to overcome a lot of adversity in their childhood, while other patients will be overcome by one or two adverse childhood events. It is important to understand the link. Screen for ACEs and get a social history. Build connections with the resources in your community so you can connect patients with the appropriate care from qualified healthcare providers. This collaborative care model will get patients on the path to resilience. This has been a production of the College of the Arts and Media and the College of Medicine at Central Michigan University.